Thank you.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. To be respectful of your time, I'd like to start on time and continue on through our march of upgrades. You're right, you are almost as tall as I am.
Yes.
Except I'm on a riser.
You're on a riser. Yeah.
I'm the shorter Rick Claus, Senior Technical Evangelist at Microsoft.
I'm the taller Joey Snow, also Senior Technical Evangelist at Microsoft. So this is part two.
Yes. Part two.
Our three-part series. Who was in part one?
Congratulations. You came
back. Congratulations. You came back. Thank you.
Don't forget your evaluations.
Yes.
Must remember your evaluations.
Now, that being said, if you were not in part two, sorry,
part one. Yeah.
I'm in Madrid, right?
Yeah. You got it.
Good. Okay. I'm in the right place. If you were not in our first session, it's okay. We've got plenty of information. We'll catch you up. We'll bring you right up to speed.
And again, you can always catch any of these sessions in from Madrid at channel9@msdn.com. Click on the events tab, choose Tech Ed Madrid, and you'll be able to find it by session code to be able to catch up, just in case you want to have some assistance falling asleep or something.
Absolutely. And actually, right now, days one and two are already posted.
Yeah.
So if you miss something the first 2 days, you can catch up. Day three, it started. I just haven't checked it lately. So
the first session was about Active Directory. The next session that we're going to be talking about today with MDCB 348 is Networking Infrastructure and Management. Lovely piece of stuff in the middle of the stack, if you will, that you have to worry about making sure that it's working and going correctly. And we started off the last one with, again, an informal survey that I created and deployed through Twitter, through Facebook, through LinkedIn, just haphazardly asking people, hey, by the way, when you're faced with an upgrade, what is the piece of your infrastructure that you are the most concerned with upgrading? And the results were rather mixed. Interesting, it's completely non-formal. IDC did not sanction this, neither did Forrester or Gartner or anyone else like that. This was simply 200 people, I think, that answered or something like that.
It was a Rickster CDN sanctioned survey.
You got it. I should copyright that. 23 responses came back basically saying that they are most concerned about application servers. That is the one bucket that we will not be touching with this, because each individual type of application server has their own requirements for how you go ahead and do a migration or an upgrade to the more current version, and you're better off finding out more from those particular vendors, including Microsoft with Exchange, with SharePoint, or third-party solutions as well. The rest of the stuff, domain controllers and Active Directory came in at number 22 for votes, the second highest. We covered that in the previous session. All the remainder, basically 60% of what's left, comes down to about file servers and networking stuff.
Which is the next two sessions.
You got it. That's why we covered it that way. So that's where we happen to sit.
All right. So before we jump on, I'm going to bring everybody up to speed. Where we were before we started the last session. So if you were here, you can take the next minute off and rest your brain, because you're in a food coma from lunch, because I am too. Basically, what we did is we started with an infrastructure that had a 2003 domain controller. Actually had two of them. We brought one up to 2008, upgraded it to 2012. Brought in a brand new 2012 domain controller, finally got rid of that old 2003 domain controller. We upped our forest and domain functional levels. So at this point, what we're left with is a few 2003 networking servers.
Yeah, member servers, basically. They have no extra roles besides networking services and file services.
So it's now time to approach and address those, and we've got some file services as well that we're going to address in the third session.
Yep.
So...
My question for you that I have right now is, let me see what it is. What is the most important networking service in your environment? Anybody?
DNS.
DHCP. I would say it's a tie between either of those two.
IP phones, right, which rely on...
DHCP to be able to work.
Yes.
DHCP over there.
Certificate server.
Is interesting.
Yeah.
There actually is no correct answer to this. I just would like to see where your headspace is. But ideally, again, I remember in the old days, back in the dark ages, before there was TCP/IP stacks, I had to manage and work with 10 base T Ethernet. And had to worry about the physical a lot, with whether or not things were terminated, and 10 base 2, actually. 10 base 2, not 10 base T, 10 base 2. that basically had a lot of physical issues. You had the terminators were wrong, the wrong ohms were used for terminators, you had bouncing stuff going back and forth. So physical became important. It's become less important now because it's all basically Cat 5, Cat 6, Cat 6E, whatever it happens to be, gigabit, 10 gigabit and above, and that sort of stuff now too. So basically that's more like a telephone cable patch and play and you're good to go.
Yeah.
Right? You less worry about the physical. But then you have to worry an awful lot more about the addressing, working your way up the stack, right? You got TCP/IP address and you got to worry about. We found out the hard way last night some fun stuff with incomplete replications with Active Directory integrated DNS zones that didn't allow things to finish and then records that were wrong. The one that got us the most, though, was interesting. It was a misconfiguration of, in my opinion, the most important service, which is obviously DNS.
Yep.
Where it had the wrong name server start of authority record pointing to a machine that no longer existed, and it was hard-coded. And so it couldn't fix itself. It couldn't register domains. It was just a nightmare, absolute nightmare. And all it was again, 10.0.10.5 as opposed to 10.0.10.10.
Yes.
I think it was. So one tiny little thing, one octet, basically broke the entire Active Directory. So it's a toss-up between DNS and DHCP. What do you think? DNS, DHCP?
I'm kind of along the same lines. I mean, DNS is obviously the, you know, kind of the lights-on thing. DHCP for me, and some of the things that we'll talk about as we go through this session, extremely important because that's the clients, that's the phones. Those are those things there.
Now, I'm curious. Are people in here the network guy that handles IP addressing and port allocation and stuff like that and Cisco, iOS and that sort of thing inside your environments? Put up your hands if you are.
Are you the network guy? Are you half the network guy?
You probably wear multiple hats. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So first of all, they don't go away. You absolutely need to have the network guys. They should be your best friend for this whole section because you're going to be working in partnership with them. What I will mention is that we are not going to be tackling the biggest gorilla in the room, which is IPv6. We're not covering IPv6 in this. Obviously, that's another whole thing you should start to be thinking about how to be able to get all those chairs and toasters and pencil sharpeners on the internet with their own address, which you can do with IPv6.
I can put my toaster on the internet.
You could, and even your fridge will talk to it and tell you when it needs to have toast. So we're not going to be covering IPv6, but obviously you should know that since 2008 R2, we've had the ability to have IPv6 inside our stack. Since 2012, it's been dual-homed, and 2012 R2 is obviously IPv6 ready and ready to go as well. IPv6 in 2012 R2 actually has a translation gateway to be able to translate between IPv4 and IPv6. There's obviously hardware vendors you can use as well. But we're not covering that. We're sticking with, again, getting you up to 2012, getting you using the most advanced services, still using IPv4 inside your environment.
The whole idea gets you ready for the next platform, right? We announced this week Server 2012 R2, well, actually 2 weeks ago and showed you more Server 2012 R2. To get there, the easiest path, get up current, get up to 2012.
Now, when it comes to networking, you mentioned IP phones, which is rather interesting. I didn't actually catch your name, but it's very interesting that you mentioned it. Because people expect the network to be a dial tone, right? Literally, they expect when they plug in the cable or when they click on the SSID to be able to join the network, it's a dial tone. It's always there. There's never a problem. There's no congestion. There's no issues. There's no routing problems, no DNS problems. They expect it to work. And as soon as something doesn't work with IP addressing, that's when your phone starts to ring, unless it's an IP phone, in which case you can't. Basically, you have to look after these individual systems, otherwise they turn into a state of neglect. And I was just recently last week in London.
Yes.
And I was very happy and pleasantly warm inside when I saw all these phone booths all over the place, because payphones still exist. Over in the States, it's harder and harder to find payphones anywhere, because it's assumed everyone has cell phones, right? So again, you have to go in and do maintenance and upkeep on these systems on a regular basis, and it's a challenge, and everyone does it in their own way and own fashion, and we've got some solutions for you for that.
So this basically comes down to the needs and challenges that you have. Now, we sat down to talk about building these sessions and identified the fact that, okay, great, we've got a lot of new technologies come out, and a lot of times we'll get up here on stage and show you all sorts of pretty new things. Reality is that you are sitting on the other side of the fence, and both of us have been there as well. We have certain needs that we need to address. We need to start simplifying things. We made things really overcomplicated. We talked about this in the last session around Active Directory, how we went all of a sudden from one little domain that has just, you know, everything in it, our resources, our users and everything, to these forests with these trust relationships bouncing back and forth and everything else. The thing is to kind of simplify it. Because when you simplify it, it allows us to provide the services to our end users and to our customers. Because let's face it, guys, we are service providers to our customers as IT. We need to be able to guarantee those high levels of service levels, right? Those SLAs. Now, you may not necessarily have one written down, but my guess is we're all working to accomplish the same thing. We can no longer keep chasing our tails and firefighting every day of the week. We're not able to move IT forward, which ideally, that's what we have to do, not just from a business perspective, but also from a personal and our career perspective. Because if you do nothing but chase your tail, you're not able to move forward and move on. We need to have better manageability, greater control. We showed you just through the few demos that we did in the earlier session, and you'll see it a lot through here, Server Manager. Just a very, very basic tool that gives you a lot more manageability and gives you that control that you need and gives us the ability to do things really from our desks, right? Yeah. We also talk about this idea of having continuous availability. It's not just, hey, did we reach our service levels? It's like, there's an expectation that these services exist. Rick, you said it right, dial tone.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think about it. I walk into the office, I open up my laptop, and I connect. Or in our world today, I go to the coffee shop. I'm from Seattle, so it's Starbucks, right? I go to Starbucks. There's one about every three or four houses down. And I expect to get on the internet or even on the airplane. Rick and I have been traveling around doing a tour talking about this stuff. And I was frustrated one afternoon when we were on an airplane in the United States that had wireless. And I couldn't do my expense report, right? Because it was there was a period of an outage there. So the demand on IT, it's not just your IT leadership's expectation, but it's also the demand of the users and what they expect now. It's a lot different than what it used to be. 9 to 5, it used to be okay. We work from 9 to 5. At 6 o'clock, we can take everything down, work on it, do what we need to do. That does not exist today. Or if it does exist in your world, congratulations, because you've got it really good, right? The other thing too, with those demands on IT and with the demands on business, it's pretty obvious. And I know here in Europe, there's a lot of tough economical times. Same within the States. We're just hopefully trying to push our way out of it. What is the first budget do you think companies start looking at cutting apart from training, right? It goes to IT, right? They're not walking up to you going, how much money do you need? We've got armored cars full of it. Go out and replace every one of your servers every 2 years.
Well, it could be an armored car business that they're in, though.
Could be. Yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that. We need to push the business forward with more pressure on us from our users, with more pressure on us from management, less budget, and probably even less resources to IT, right? Cut the staff, cut the training. But in order to really push the business forward, business does need IT, and IT needs to be flexible, and it needs to be agile. So we need to be able to provide our customers with some of those flexible and agile solutions. So what do we have to think about? We have to think about keeping services online, and those services have to be resilient. It's not okay anymore to have that 10-year-old server that's providing that dial tone that we know is going to go down and cause a severity one outage every week and a half, right? We have to address that. The other thing that we have to do is the more devices, the more things that are coming into play, it's cell phones, it's wireless, it's network, it's this, that, and the other, everybody's connecting the things, we have to actually be able to manage all of that. And it's not just managing those devices and things that we've shown through our keynotes. It's also that underlying infrastructure. It's all that addressing space, right? We need to have that there. It's not just a single world where IT makes the decisions on every device that comes in. We talked a lot, Brad mentioned it in the keynote on Tuesday, where our users are essentially demanding these devices in play, right? And with that, you deal with multi-tenancy. That's not just two customers in a single location. It could be multiple devices. It could be having to support, in our case, your poor little laptop there.
It's ready for an install, man.
Yeah, it's ready for an install, absolutely.
The USB stick is waiting for R2 on this guy.
Exactly. We've got multi-tenant environment in there as well that we have to support, and we have to maximize those resources, right? More for the dollar every single time.
The part that I like when you're looking at these new changes is also the ability to start to take advantage of the stuff that you saw in the keynote for newer hardware and newer capabilities within the servers themselves. So being able to do RDMA, being able to do faster network bandwidth between your different servers, to do faster movement of resources and stuff like that. And also to be able to look after an extra layer of resiliency by having, in this case, a solution that we have for it is simply inbox Nick teaming to be able to do stuff. So we think that we got a solution for you with 2012 for a lot of these things, and then we'll be continuing on with the third session in the afternoon on the storage side of things. So this one's going to be talking specifically about networking. So with resiliency of IP addressing, we'll see. I know you got a story, but I'm going to save that until we actually get to that one little section.
Yeah.
But basically, a lot of people said DHCP was a problem for them. And again, a lot of times DHCP may or may not be that dusty box in the corner that's actually going off and serving up addresses, or it might have been replaced by a third-party solution that potentially offers some more value, or it literally is just the router because it's a small office you're working with that's being able to do it for you, and it's simply a Linux daemon that's passing out boot P addresses to people. Those need to be looked at as far as a way of being able to replace them and or upgrade them to the latest version of stuff. And then I love this one. I asked about the network people for what they do on things. With how you handle looking after your IP address management as a resource as opposed to simply the way to get to a system. So we have the first step, I will say, towards better IP address management with something that we call IPAM that's in the box. It's not it's a V1 implementation in 2012, and it's there again in 2012 R2 that's even better. They actually have a hands-on lab that you could do downstairs about IPAM in 2012 R2, and you'll be able to have access to that one later on after the session is done at some point in the future. And then finally, WSUS. We picked on WSUS because patching is obviously a necessary evil. As I came back from lunch, actually, one of my notes machines over here that has my notes on it came up with a "you must reboot in 1 hour." So I figured I better do the reboot during lunch to finish it off so I could come back up and go. So WSUS, we're going to do our best to basically guide you on how this is actually done and why you would use it. And obviously, you've got stuff at a much larger scale to be able to go off and to handle IP address management and patching with ConfigMan and Windows Intune and things like that. So
a lot of what we talked about in the first session, it is kind of high level, and then we'll show you how. So how do we get there? How do we...
Well, I found this online for a great description. I kind of feel like whenever I'm approaching this kind of thing, because when you're dealing with networking, it's really something you don't just kind of jump into and do. You have to be delicate with it, and it can be rather complex. So I found that as a great direction map for how to get there.
That's kind of like when you're giving me directions in the car how to get to the places when we're on the tour. That's exactly map form what that looks like.
So how do I get there then, if that's the case?
Well, Rick, let me bing that for you. We have a beautiful set of tools, and I mentioned this in the previous session. It's the Windows Server 2012 migration tools. So if you go to your favorite search engine, type in Windows Server 2012 migration, you'll see where it is. Now, of course, we've had a lot of news lately, so it's pushed down a little bit on the page. But the great part of these tools is we tell you what do you have to do before, what do you have to do during, what do you have to do after, and give you the resources for troubleshooting all in one location, along with a pretty robust set of tools that we're actually going to demonstrate for you here in this session to provide some migration from previous versions of Windows up to the current platform. So this is from 2003 up to 2012 and beyond.
Now, one thing I will point out is that with the previous session with Active Directory, they were all inbox tools. Same thing with this. These are all inbox tools we're talking about that you're going to be using, managing, working, and migrating with. They simply require an installation. They're freely available and downloadable, and they're well documented. So these are no additional cost.
At no additional charge to you, absolutely. That's a big part of what we're trying to do here, is kind of show you a lot of the tools that you get for free. So the Windows Server Migration Tools. We're going to talk about migrating, probably the worst experience in terms of migration that I had in my career in IT, the simple little service known as DHCP, right? Part of migrating DHCP, we have this set of tools, and they are the server migration tools, otherwise known as SMIG. And to do this, there's a set of PowerShell that runs underneath it. Now, if you have Server 2012 and beyond, you can, Server 2008 R2 and beyond.
Yeah, you're good to go.
You're good to go. It's already in the box. You don't have to download anything. If it's 2003, you do need to download the bits and update your frameworks to run PowerShell. But it's not hard PowerShell. Really, there's only three or four settings that you really absolutely have to know and a couple of alternate ones.
Yeah, I'll just clarify one thing. You're going to want to use the migration tools that are included with the current version of the software you're migrating to. So 2012 was an example.
Yes.
That's where you're going to find your source package of migration tools to create the packages for the other OSs. And you'll see me do that in the first demo that's coming up here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to make sure we're crystal clear on it. They're all the same PowerShell commands that you're talking about there with all the different versions, but there's specific nuances to the tools.
So the first tool I like, it's my favorite one, because it tells me what I can do. And that's GitSmig Server Feature. So what this does is it looks at an individual server and it tells me the roles that those migration tools are actually capable of migrating. Simple. So I can go through and I can say get SMIG server feature. It'll list off, hey, look, it's DHCP, it's this. We can migrate it. The other two are very simple. It's export and it's import.
So those are my favorite. They're the workhorses.
The workhorses, right? The last two deal with mostly file server data. And we'll get to that when we talk about it. One is send SMIG server data. The other is receive SMIG server data. This enables us to actually migrate file server data online over the wire. So one is sending and one is receiving. We'll get to more details on that
in the next session as we proceed.
Yep.
Yep.
So the processes I mentioned. First of all, and we talked about this in the last session, it's discovery. It's doing the homework, right? I don't expect that most of you can immediately, after this 75-minute session, run back and know exactly every step that you're going to need to do in order to proceed in your migration. However, with a little bit of diligence and the help of this session, and of course the online replays, you should be able to. So the first thing, what do I need to migrate? What are the things that I'm most concerned about? What are those first things that I need to do? Figure that out. Go to the migration portal, right, which I helped Bing for Rick there, and prepare. Get the information. As I mentioned before, we give you all the steps, what to do before, what to do during, what to do after, and any troubleshooting resources.
I guess I probably should have updated the screenshot. The TechNet Migration Portal is talking about migrating to 2008 R2 beta.
I'll update that for the next time.
Sorry.
Nice work on your slides. At least you have slides this time.
Yeah.
And then what we're going to do is from the source the source server, we're going to export those settings to some sort of temporary storage, then we're going to import them in on the destination server, right? It was pretty clear in the last session, most of you don't do upgrades. I assume that's still the case now. As I mentioned before, with the file server data, we can send and receive as well, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, so let me actually show you a bit about how to actually get these packages up and ready to go, in case you haven't seen it before. So this is one of my 2012 boxes. It's DHCP number one. DHCP number one is currently just a member server with nothing else on it. To be able to get the tools, quite simple. Manage, add roles and features. Go in. I'm assuming you've seen this Windows before. Again, I could do this if I wanted to from a Windows 8 desktop to a remote machine, and it will still work. Although you would have to actually execute those tools directly on that remote machine. So this is my source server. There he is. It's not a role, it's a feature. Scrolling down, Windows Migration Server Migration Tools. Hit Next, hit Install, and let it go through and pull off the PowerShell files, get them registered and ready to go on the local box. Pretty simple. Have to wait a little bit as it goes.
Tap dance?
I'm thinking if I should do a little bit of a dance or not. Or
I don't think anybody wants to see
it. It's almost done.
So essentially, these bits are actually there,
yep.
Right? Once we get these bits with the most current generation of the tool set, as Rick mentioned, We need to actually prepare the package that we're going to give to our down-level servers.
Right.
So now that you've got them and they're
so now that I got them, there. I'm actually going to use the start menu.
Okay.
Start screen, sorry. And there is one that is called Windows Server Migration Tools. What that is simply is a pre-configured PowerShell that has the module loaded for me. I don't have to go ahead and initialize the module. I'm just going to make this a little bit larger so you guys can see it, because it's difficult to see at the back. Once that's done, I'm just going to go in here and say cd / Windows System 32 Server Migration Tools directory structure, and it's called smig deploy is the executable file you have to run. And this is where you basically are going to be running this to be able to extract the appropriate package, because I need to get a version specific to my source server, not my target server, my source server. So my source server is, sorry.
Your source server.
My source server. Not my source of the package. No. My source of where DHCP is. I'm trying to move on.
So we're going
to
migrate DHCP. This is where DHCP lives today. And this server is a 2003 server.
Right. But it's actually what I call a unicorn server.
A unicorn server?
A unicorn server because for some reason, the guy that I had helped me build the demo set decided to install the 64-bit version of 2003, which almost nobody uses. But you have to match up the architecture, AMD 64, and you have to match up the OS version of WS03, and then do a path to where you want them to be extracted to. I'm looking at Joey to ensure that I am not making any typos.
Expect me to keep up with that?
You got it, man.
All right.
And because it's PowerShell, I forgot you have to put .exe.
You
got to
put the dot for it. Yep.
What did I forget?
You need to do this. There you go.
There we go. Let's just do it that way. That way I can't mess it up. One more time.
So again, this is PowerShell, so we needed the period forward slash in the beginning of it. We'll give it the architecture. We also come with the 32-bit. That's actually more common that you would see. So you do x86 there. And the OS type. Now, these tools also work moving forward, right? So you can create these packages for 2008, 2008 R2. And you'll see he's now extracted that. Now, what this is it's just a package.
You got it.
It's a set of tools that we're going to copy over.
There it is there. I'm going to cheat, so I'm just going to copy this guy. The guy I'm going to want to talk to is my, this is my 2003 DNS DHCP guy. And paste. Obviously, I'm using the administrative share. I could use my temporary storage server and dump it up there and then get it on the other side. So that's the extraction, the first set of tools. Next up on my 2003 guy. Let's change into those tools. SMT_WS03_AMD64.
Got a CD, buddy.
There we go. Smig deploy. That extracts them, makes sure it's all there, good to go, and pops up the PowerShell window with the module already loaded. Let's make it larger so guys can see in the back. Too large, right there. So he's good. And that is the tools deploy.
All right. So the next thing that we have to do, now that we've got our tools, is actually go in and do a DHCP migration.
Yeah, this is extremely detailed and complex build out slide. So our source, let me explain this here. Our source server is 2003 R2 or 2008 or 2008 R2. There actually is an individual package specifically for each one of those. So I did WS03, there's also WS08 and WS08 R2. So make sure you know that when you do it. And then we bring up a member server that is running 2012, and that's going to have DHCP on it. That's it. That's it.
not incredibly difficult. One interesting thing about our tool set here, Rick, is you switch over, and if you want to start getting your command in, the first thing that we're going to do is if you actually forget to install the DHCP role on your target server, the tool will actually install the role. Were you aware of this?
I was not, and...
So the tool will actually install the role, but in the interest of time, because that actually takes a little bit longer because we've got to use PowerShell remote and those things, we're going to go ahead and get DHCP installed on our destination server. Is it already?
So this is our target server, which is DHCP 1, 2012. Going to go in and add in the role of DHCP. I don't have to worry about configuring it. I simply install it. Take all the defaults. Restart if required. Doesn't require a restart, but let that guy go off and get her done. Now, to be able to start to do this backup, I'm going to flip this guy back over to my 2003 box. And the 2003 side, first of all, let me just show you DHCP that's up and running here. We've got a very vast and complex network of DHCP inside this demo environment. It has a single scope, 10.0 to 10.0 of a main scope. It has an address pool of about 99 addresses, 100 addresses, and you can see here it's bristling full with two addresses. One of them is a reservation for our mail server with a bad MAC address, but it's just a fake one. Okay. And then one of them actually is a client that did get used and is using it right now for DHCP just fine. And obviously it has scope options as well, so it's, you know, pretty typical, except for the fact it's not exactly busy right now.
So one of the things that I recommend folks do before you start a DHCP migration is to change your lease period, right? By default, that lease time is, 7 days? I like to change that lease period twice during a migration, right? Once when the project gets started, because what it's going to do is it's going to basically have the clients communicating quicker back to the DHCP server. So I reduce it in half first, and then on the day of the actual migration, I'll reduce it even down further. Some people like to do a day, depending on your network traffic. I did it with 4 hours, right, which was having the clients request every couple of hours during our migration period. This just speeds things along.
Now, I was going to say, with your migration project sort of stuff, with 2003, I have the ability to simply do a backup. That's going to back up my database and back up my information that's critical to me, and then I can simply do a restore on a new box, and then I'm done migrating. Like, why are you even bothering with this stuff, man?
Oh, I have a story for you, my friend. I have a story for you. See,
You should do a backup, obviously, here, just before
you
start.
Absolutely. And it's really simple to do. You can actually just right-click and back it up now so that you had it.
You don't have to worry
about this.
Done.
And done. I manage a call center, as I mentioned in my previous life. We had 65,000 desktops located in 60-some-odd locations around the world, 2,000 servers. And each one of the locations around the world had a DHCP server. And we were now tasked with a project as we shifted from NT4 to Windows 2000 and then up to 2003 with starting to decommission all these random DHCP servers, because what we started doing is instead of having individual T1 lines, the internet became more prevalent. We were actually able to leverage normal internet lines and basically create VPN tunnels from all of our remote sites into our main data centers. And they were more reliable than what we had with the original T1s or satellite connections or ISDN. Believe me, we had it all. So I was tasked with this project. Now, one of the challenges in a call center, as I mentioned before, if you do not take phone calls, you do not make money. So when I was tasked with this project, I found this beautiful tool in the resource kit. It's called DHCP EXIM, E-X-I-M, stands for export and import. And this tool was going to be my savior. So I went to the very first project, we'd planned it all out, I was ready to go, I did a backup of the database, I ran DHCP EXIM, it exported the database, it exported all of the active leases, I was good to go, brought it into the new server, and it brought everything in, save 10% of active leases.
That's a good ratio, 90%, I'd take that.
Across 65,000 systems.
No.
Okay. When outages and people not working, and believe me, my agents loved it because my call center agents do about anything they can do to not be on the phone, right? So they thought it was fantastic when things didn't work. But essentially what it required us to do is to go through and do releases and renews on individual systems, right? 10% failure is not okay by my standards when I'm dealing with this environment. So there was some lost revenue, downtime, and of course, because there's downtime, somebody has to write an executive report, right? Yeah, that was even more pleasant than the actual migration, right? So this tool here is fantastic because we can actually move the DHCP behind the scenes without anybody noticing.
Right. Well, technically, yes. there's a little bit of a part that they're going to notice is basically the very first thing you have to do is you have to basically freeze your existing DHCP server that's running Microsoft DHCP from issuing new addresses. So the easy way to do that one there is simply do a stop service DHCP server. So he's now temporarily stopped. And then I go off and I do my export tool, export SMIG server settings. In this case, I'm going to flag it for a feature. Feature ID is DHCP that I want to migrate. I then want to do an IP config of the addresses on the local box, because you can actually migrate the IP address of the local box to the new box. But why is that important to do that?
Because DHCP is a broadcast.
So you got broadcast and directed packets,
right? And directed packets.
So if a client gets an address from the DHCP server, it's going to expect to go back to them to get it renewed. So you got to move the IP address with them as well. Am I spelled that right? I just noticed a typo. And then I need to have a path, which is /migration/DHCP. Just as a place to store it. This is your temporary storage area. And verbose. Now, whenever you do an export or an import, it's going to actually encrypt it, so you have to go in and choose a super secret password, and then it goes off, collects the data, does the export, and gives me a nice result because I said SMIG server with verbose. So basically, this guy's now good to go for being able to be backed up. Now, one thing you have to worry about when you're doing a DHCP migration is you have to associate the old scope with the MAC address of what subnet it was on to the new scope of the same server. Sorry, the new server that's going to be on the same subnet. So basically, you have to match up MAC address to MAC address. The easiest way you can do this is simply do an ipconfig/all, and then pipe that to c://migration/DHCP/ipsettings.txt. Ugh. Oh, I did that. Oh, thank you.
Is it DCHP?
My dyslexia is kicking in, so let's go in and get the right one here. Migration DCHP. Yes.
He just renamed that folder.
I could just DCHP.
We've just created a new service right here in front of you all. Let's hear it for Rick.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I wish that was that easy to do. And then next thing you have to do is do an SSH command to be able to remove the authorization of the old server.
Now you could do this part also through the GUI.
If you wanted to.
Opening it up and remove it.
Trying to make sure I spell it correctly, because now I'm concerned. And you have to put in the IP address of what it was. It removes it. And then now basically copy the contents of the migration incorrect folder name, this stuff, over to my temporary storage area, which is 10.0.10.200. It's literally just a file share. And I've got a DHCP folder there. And that's my old data. So I'm actually going to delete them and then put my new data there. There you go. So that's my data that just happened from 322. I've now got that guy saved. Lastly, you know what? I don't need this guy anymore. /S/T1. Gone. He's no longer needed anymore. End.
Now, what we would typically do now is leave that server in a shutdown state, move to the next phase. Any machine that still had an IP lease, still active, still running, all good, right? At least for the next hour and a half until it tries to ask again, because we reduce that time frame down. Again, it's all based on your comfort and how you want to do it, that active lease time. So now we're going to go to the destination.
This is my 2012 DHCP number one server. So it is the one that I installed the binaries on but did not configure, as well as going ahead and the initial source of my migration tools. Therefore, I have the migration tools available to run from a perspective of getting them ready to go, which is already done. And I also want to make sure that I don't make a big typo mistake. And so I'm going to very simply use this. Here's some highlights for you guys. You need to have the source MAC address, which I saved in that text file. I need the destination or target MAC address from a local IP config. There's ipconfig/all. And this is my local server. And this is my MAC address that I need to be concerned of. So over here, you can see I'm going to be doing an import SMIG server settings, feature of DHCP, bring over the IP configuration, all the settings. My source physical address I'll put in just one moment. And my target physical address is this particular MAC address. My source one is 10.0.10.200/migration. Here is my DHCP and IP address settings. This is the MAC address of the source guy, which was my 2003 server. So let's go back over here, replace source MAC with him, and let's go and grab all of those guys there and simply say execute. Notice what it is, basically source and destination, source and target, force the meshing of them together, bring it across. The path where I'm going to be getting the content from is the correctly spelled DHCP, and give me your verbose. Bring it up and run. And, oh, you know what? Copy that. I did not initialize the commandlet, so instead, I'll do it in the proper window right here. And run it there instead. So it found the migration file. It's now asking me for the password I locked it up with. If I can type it correctly. Password. Yep.
Yep.
Making sure it's the right one. It's a secret one.
I don't know. You typed it.
I know. It's not password. I did make it a little bit stronger than that. Not much, but a little bit. Then it's going to go through and basically parse the data, authenticate and de-encrypt it, collect the data, go ahead and bring it up.
Replacing the MAC address?
This will actually give me an error message because it's going to basically stop and say, ugh, I used to be IP address 23. Now, magically, when it goes ahead and does the migration, it's going to switch the MAC address and the IP address of that virtual machine to be 10.0.10.14. Here it comes. There's the error message.
Okay.
So my IP address actually changed right there in this box. And you can see here, if I scroll back through the verboseness of it all, you can see here that I was going to be doing an IP configuration, global IP config, and Windows DHCP coming across. And you can see here that it matches up the Ethernet adapters and also the scopes, and everything's done. Basically, migration is now complete. What I can now do on this guy is DHCP manager. Go up and manage my authorized servers. I need to start them first, actually. Sorry.
Now, a lot of times what will happen is in this migration process, if you didn't have the DHCP service installed and you let the migration tools install it, or if you've done some underlying IP changes as well, you may need to restart the service or just make sure the DHCP service is started. Then we authorize that service, yeah, and we're able to go in.
Yeah. I can do it this way, too. Complete the configuration. I'll just do it this way.
Okay.
So this basically completion of the configuration is going to go through and authorize my system. Go ahead and hit commit. It's done. Hit close. Now, DHCP manager is going to be much happier when I fire him back up again. You can see here that he's basically been added. He was authorized by the completion of the wizard, so he's inside Active Directory. That's the 10.0.10.14, but notice it's 2012 DHCP1. It's no longer 2003 guy to be able to do it. So simply bring him up. Once he's there, start the services because he's now been authorized.
Absolutely. Yeah, interrupt at any time. Is there an option to set the registry key to not authorize a DHCP server? Has that been removed? I honestly don't have the answer for that.
The registry key has not been removed. There's no way to automate it using the built-in tools. It's a process you could do manually yourself if you wanted to with a group policy. But it's a security functionality. Basically, you must be part of Active Directory and authorized to be able to use it. Your choice if you want to use it or not. So in this case, you can see here, my client is there and live, and my mail server happens to be working as well. It's currently an inactive address, but it happens to be still there. And to really kind of test this out, just to prove that it worked, here's my client system. And if you go in and take a look here under status, you'll see that currently his DHCP server is 10.14, and it was an address that was assigned back about a half an hour ago or so. I can simply go in here and say disable and enable. He's going to go off and do a directed request back to 10.14. It came back very, very quickly, as opposed to failing. And if I take a look at details here, you'll now see that it's now 10.14, but it was correctly renewed at 3:31, where it is. So he's now up and working. All the previous reservations are there. He has the same IP address as the previous old guy, so all existing clients are going to go back and contact him and continue to go. You must have the same number of NICs on the first and the same number of NICs on the destination in order for this to work, and you must match the migration source target, source target, source target each time you do it for this to be able to work. That is your migration of DHCP to 2012.
So in Windows Server 2012, DHCP has some new goodness to it.
It does.
Now, in our world, go ahead, question, yes. What if your source DHCP server is running on a cluster? Well, you would at this point, and he picked a great time to ask this question because we talk about clustering, particularly with some new features. You're still going to export your databases the same way, but you would handle each individual server in the cluster on an individual basis, right? But all that scope information, all that configuration is going to come over. But what Rick is going to tell you about right now, I think you may rethink clustering your DHCP.
Yep. Yeah, the biggest part about this is the whole concept of being able to have basically failover without the need to have the cluster hardware. You now are using industry standard protocols to be able to exchange data between two Microsoft DHCP servers to be able to share in load balance or act as a failover hot spare for any number of scopes on a scope-by-scope basis. You could architect this that you have multiple physical servers or virtual servers that are running in your different branch offices that have individual scopes themselves, and then you have one guy that's central with good networking connectivity that has a failover hot spare for all four of those guys, and then only when it fails to work on the branch office does it get directed over on the second or third try down to the first guy. They'll know exactly how many addresses have been used and issued because they continuously talk to each other as far as replication is concerned, using the same standard industry protocols, or they could work as a load balancer, where again, if you have the old-fashioned idea of split scopes, you don't have to worry about split scopes anymore. You can now simply use a simple scope and then have it replicated to the other side, have it set up as a load balance, and then splits the addresses between the two of them, being able to do it.
Now, here's the beautiful thing about this. It's not reliant upon failover clustering to do this.
Right.
It's in the box inside of Windows Server 2012. All you need, we've got one server running Windows Server 2012 now with DHCP. The only thing we need now, Rick, is a second server of Windows Server 2012 that's running DHCP.
Right.
And then we can actually get this failover.
So this is, again, it's a standard member server, part of the same domain, 2012 DHCP, and this guy is called DHCP2, very inventive name. You've seen the standard process of going through and installing DHCP role on the box. That's all I need to have. Go ahead and do the install. That guy goes ahead and does the install. While it's there, I need to wait till it's finished and configured to basically activate it and authorize it. Once it's been configured, activated, and authorized, you don't have to make any scope details at all. You simply make it happy on your domain. Once that's done, you go back to the first guy that owns the scope, and you establish the relationship. It's a very simple process to establish
that. So who's using split scopes today, A20? Isn't management of that just awesome, right? Spreadsheet, yeah, going, what's here? Or is it on a sticky note? This one holds these, right? I'm not kidding. That's how I did it. I'm really being honest with you. That's no longer needed. It's no longer needed because both systems are talking to each other. And we're just going to configure it here just in a matter of moments. You're just going to go ahead and activate that
service. So basically, I'm activating and authorizing, basically. It's now done. It's set to go. go back to my first guy, and I simply choose the properties of the scope, and you'll see here the ability to say configure failover. Right mouse click, configure failover. Here's the wizard, here's the scope I'm looking at. You can choose them all, maybe only individuals, your choice, how you want to set this up. It's on a per scope settings basis. It says, okay, what is the name and address of the partner DHCP server to which you're going to be talking to? I'm going to go ahead here and simply find, did I not start it?
I don't think you started the service.
Oh, okay, let me go back and start it.
The great thing about doing this on a scope by scope basis is because there are certain scopes that you're not really so concerned with the IP addresses in terms of failing over, right? Other scopes, test environments, dev environments, where it's not that big of a deal. You don't need all that overhead of a big failover cluster just to support these. So you can really focus in on those main production workloads and move those over.
Let's try this again. It's just it was a matter of timing, I do believe. Let's go back and try this. Go ahead and say configure failover, bring it back, add server. You know what, let's type it in. 2012 DHCP 1, no, 2.corp.contoso.com. It gives you a default name, which is simply combining the two of those names together. Maximum lead time for the client basically is how long the client will be allowed to use the address in excess of when the lease expires before it gets issued a brand new one. So you can configure this to what you like. For this demo, I'm going to change this from 1 hour to 1 minute. I don't recommend that. Load balance or hot standby. Load balance is going to split the addresses of the entire scope across both of them, or you can choose the balance yourself. Hot standby, basically, it's going to sit there and wait for an answer to not be answered by one of the main guys. It's going to keep in touch. When it can't talk to the main server, it's going to all of a sudden, oops, there's a problem. Let me go ahead and try again. Okay, I'm going to start taking over. So I'm going to do a load balance to keep it simple, and then put in a shared secret between the two servers. Hit next, gives you confirmation, hit finish, and then the important part here is you say successful, configuring failover successful, and you're good to go.
And that's
important
it.
To note, this is a thing that you're going to be doing between 2012 domain controllers. You can't do this between a 2012 and a non-Microsoft compatible system that's out there. Hit close, and he's now done. To see it actually work back on 2012 number 2, look at that. The scope magically appeared. On the other side, it has an address pool, and it has leases, and it's all set to go, and it knows of what leases that happen on those individual clients.
I like that. That's a very, very good thing, right? Right out of the box, no additional things. I have a question here in front.
What if you have DHCP helper addresses? If you have a lot of DHCP helpers around the network that are all pointing to the primary DHCP server?
So DHCP helpers and helper addresses.
Yep. Yeah, so again, what's going to happen here, if you have helpers pointing to an existing, or if you have existing client leases pointing to an existing, the existing guy's still there, still going to work. If he renews an address or if he issues a new address, that's perfectly fine. He'll let his partner know that that's no longer available to be issued back out again on a timely fashion. Likewise as well, if the other guy happens to capture it because the first guy is too busy, he'll let the other guy know that they're there. So they continuously talk back and forth. It's not using RPCs. It's not using funky ports or any kind of extra permissions. It's using industry standard. Don't ask me the port because I forget.
What if the primary server crashes, so you only have the secondary, the DHCP2?
You know what? How about if I show you? Even easier. So it's low balance right now. Even though it's low balance, what I'm going to do is I'm basically going to simulate a failure on this first guy by simply going through here and saying deactivate the scope for this one guy. Now that he's deactivated, back on my client system, if you remember, he was using 10.14. Go in and hit details. You can see 10.14 is the address that he's using. If I go in and say, again, disable and enable, it's going to go off and try to renew the address on that guy. It's going to attempt contact him. He's not going to answer. He then is going to simply say, give me another address, please. And you'll see in just a moment here that he gets it from number 2 and pulls it up. This is that 1 minute window waiting. There we go. Here it comes. Go up and say properties and status and details. And you'll now see that It's actually 10.0.10.25 that issued it. If I go back and take a look at the scope properties and status, you'll see that now, instead of being 50-50 of addresses under stats, you'll see that there's one more taken out of this other guy. And this client will now go and talk to number 25. He won't fail back over to the first one because they're load balanced between both of them. And it just continues to work.
Now, for your helpers, you're going to want to put in both DHCP servers, right? Just like anything else, you'll want both of them in there. But once you do that, it'll be able to handle it.
There's a question
at the back. It's just hand came up last minute.
Okay, we got the next one to talk about. Go ahead.
Your DHCP server is on the DC.
DHCP server, I'm sorry?
It's on the DC.
Are they on the DC?
If they are on the DC, you can't really migrate, right? Because
So the question is basically, do you have your DHCP servers on the DCs? These ones are standalone member servers because I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to AD design, that Active Directory main controllers should only do what they need to. They could be. The problem is, as soon as you do that, you now negate the ability to be able to migrate those, migrate and upgrade those guys from 2012 to become a clone domain controller. You can't clone the DHCP service between the two of them. If you come to the first session that we talked about earlier for Active Directory migration, you'd see that cloning DCs is supported in a virtualized environment, but DHCP is one of the services that cannot be cloned because the database is there.
So in our scenario, because these are not domain controllers, we're able to basically take over the IP address and the MAC address. The other way to do it is to move those active leases and those reservations. Then you start trimming your timeline down for your DHCP lease duration. So the clients will go find the new DHCP server once that old one's offline. You're still going to lose those active addresses. It will have to get the new one, but it'll happen faster. But at least you keep all of your reservations and all of your scope options and everything versus having to go and reconfigure it.
Now, in the interest of time, so I can stay on track a little bit, the world of DHCP basically has also gotten better because of something else. Yes, you don't need to have clustering to be able to do this. This is just two commodity servers. We just implemented our failover, and I demonstrated as well. But curiosity of mine is how you currently manage your IP address space right now. Pardon me? Excel spreadsheets. Anyone else use Excel spreadsheets to manage your IP address ranges?
A notepad?
Notepad is good.
Notepad? No one? Okay, WordPad.
At least you got spell check on it. It's interesting because when you're tracking IP addresses, how do you decide which range in the scope you're going to be assigning your printers versus your desktops versus wireless versus servers? I used to simply say, okay, here's my range of addresses. The first 20, do nothing with them. They're my buffer. The next 50, those are going to be my servers. The next 150 are going to be my clients, and the last 50 are going to be wireless on that one network. And that was just me in my head for what I used to do for carving up my scopes. If I got hit by a bus, no one would know my magic of how I did it unless I documented it, right? So
the red binder,
yes, you're in the first session, weren't you? If you can find that red binder, I got a prize for you. So it comes down to, there's a couple of options. Spreadsheets is one way of doing it. Pros and cons, it's cheap, it's fast. You can use the network if you wanted to. It works well with small environments. Con-wise, it's labor-intensive. It's only as good as the last time it was updated, and as so long as every person that ever statically assigns an address also uses that spreadsheet. In-house tools are better, but they generally are. I've actually talked to a bunch of guys that actually wrote a web interface and queried the servers and that sort of stuff, and you can have forms to fill out. Again, if they get hit by a bus, then that whole system falls apart because it's no longer able to be maintained. So in-house tools happen to work as well. They're a bit more up-to-date than spreadsheets are. The last one's a commercial appliance, ability to go off and basically buy a solution that does your IP address management and also does DHCP and DNS management as well. However, they tend to be quite pricey. That's out there. We have one built in, which is 2012 IPAM, and I'm going to show you the toughest part about 2012 IPAM is going through the installation and then letting it sit long enough for you to what I call humanize that installation. So let me just log on here. And I'm going to start the install because it's going to take a little bit of time to get this install up and working. Now, this is something you can put in. I call this a secondary tool. This allows you to interface with your primary tools, NetSH, DHCP Manager, DNS Admin, PowerShell. This is simply a layer on top of that that allows you to do a bunch of stuff to make it easier to manage. So I'm just going to go in here and say manage, add remove, roles to my server. It's just a member server, it's part of my domain. You've seen this wizard about 10 times, I'm sure, at least today.
At least four today.
You got it. Now, it's not a role, it is a feature. IP address management. A whole bunch of stuff comes in the background. And then a restart required. If required, go ahead and do the install. And it's going to go off and kick this guy off. IP address management, this is a database back end with some nice forms front end. You can choose to use to humanize. When I say humanize, you put your details of how you manage your environment out of your head, out of your spreadsheets, into this particular database. And then you can delegate out access to people that have no administrative access whatsoever to be able to use that address space. Imagine the ability to go through and simply say, hey, I've got a new IP-based printer coming in from a store that I bought this from. I need to have an IP address. They could literally fire up this tool or make a request to you or a junior admin and say, provision me and find me a new address inside this block of addresses, which represents the third floor in building 127 in New York. Because you put that information into it other than simply knowing that happens to be subnet 10.0.25.x with a C-class subnet. You humanize that because you put words around it because it's a database now. And then you have a level of automation and management that's now possible as well that's also trackable and audible. It would be great to be able to go in and say, I would love to know every single MAC address that IP address 10.0.25.137 ever touched in the last 6 months. This tool will go through and maintain log information about IP address use over a period of time that you choose. You can give auditors the right to be able to go off and query it and find out such information if you wanted to. So great repository of information. You don't have to use it as your primary, but if you do, you start to now unburden yourself from having to maintain all sorts of stuff. So let me show you how easy this is, at least to get started. So first off, I'm already connected to the IPAM server. You can once again install the IPAM tools as part of RSAT on a Windows 8 client. So it's great for those auditors if you wanted to. I want to go in and provision the IPAM server as the first step. Here it says, this is what it does. It manages DHCP, DNS, network policy servers, and Active Directory domain controllers for being able to work this. It then warns you, careful, because your provisioning method cannot be changed. This is the nasty part you have to be aware of. You either can do it manually, which I absolutely and abhorrently ask you, please don't do, unless you like maliciously hurting yourself. instead, you do. Oh, very good, sir. sir, you had a question? Virtual Machine Manager? Okay, good question. Basically, does this interface with Virtual Machine Manager? The answer is sort of. Because it can take information with an export and an import. Stay tuned for the R2 version, which is much better. This is the first version of it. So the way you should do this is through group policy. And the idea is that this basically allows you to scope down what you're responsible for. So I'm going to say do a group policy-based provisioning, and I'm going to call this guy something completely original, IPAM1, for my grouping of IPAM servers that are going to manage those different resources. Then it comes up and says, okay, I need you to now go and create these specifically named group policy objects at the domain level. And I need you to do that by using IPAM GPO provisioning commandlet to be able to get that done. And I'll do it for you, but you have to run this manually. Don't ask me why. This is just me helping you out, being able to finish it off. Okay.
Cover these.
Not just yet. I want to do one more thing here. Hang on. And just because I don't want you guys to have to watch the great big huge long piece of PowerShell, I'm just going to pull up my cheat sheet 10.0.10.200/migration under DHCP. Nope, did that one there already. Did I?
Yes,
I did. Networking scripts. It is import. There we go. Copy that guy there. Okay. So he's done. I did the initial phase of where it is. Hit close. He's now done. I like how this actually tracks where you are. Next up is start server discovery. By starting server discovery, this is now going to go off and basically query the repository of information, otherwise known as Active Directory, looking for all servers that have registered as a domain controller, easy enough to find, DNS services, easy enough to find, NPS servers, network policy servers, also easy enough to find, and DHCP servers. Well, they have to be authorized. That's also easy to find. Finds them all, basically. Comes back, and it runs on a scheduled basis once every 24 hours. You can kick it off yourself manually if you wanted to. Now that's done, I can go back and say select or add. Nothing yet. I did the discovery process once.
Yep.
He's now kicking. He's all done. He's been added. He's good. Well, he's now already been discovered. Let's wait and have that guy populate with a refresh. Once that's done, you then go off and you fire off an administrative PowerShell. And if you remember that great big huge long line of code that I added, I'll zoom in here so you guys can see it. Invoke GPO provisioning. The domain you're going to touch is corp.contoso.com. GPO prefix name is IPAM1. Delegated GPOs you want to use, use administrator. IPAM server FQDN, IPAM server fully qualified domain name to be able to do it. Go off and say yes. And he goes off, creates the GPOs, and goes from there. Now, while that percolates for a bit, I just wanted to come back architecturally and talk about how IPAM works to give this guy a shot. Basically, IPAM will go through, you have it installed, it uses a local database. It then goes off and is managed either by another Windows Server 2012 box with or a Windows 8 client with RSAT. It is agentless and goes off and talks to DHCP, DNS, domain controllers, and NPS servers using standard ports for remote management in Windows Server 2012. And is able to interrogate and get data from it. It then is able to go through and have a delegated role-based control, IPAM administrators, which manage everything, ASM for address space management, MSN for monitoring, and then IPAM users to simply go off and to take a look at those settings, and finally auditors to be able to run off with the auditor tools. And then you have the ability to have multiple IPAM servers configured like I did, and what you would do is you would basically scope it down of individual places. And then finally, this is where it concurrently ties into System Center Virtual Machine Manager SP1 by having some simple scripts available to basically share virtual networks and software-defined networks on that guy to bring him into the IPAM server as additional address space that you then go again to continue to humanize for what it is, for architecturally, for how this guy works.
I absolutely love the fact that this here, agentless, agentless solutions are very, very good. I hate deploying agents. I hate managing agents. So anything that we can do agentless is fantastic. So Rick is just waiting for...
The one thing I want to make sure I covered off was the installation process, because it is a bit of a pain in the butt. If you end up in a troubleshooting situation where for some reason the group policy objects were not created correctly, you forgot what you're supposed to call them, whatever it happens to be, you are able to... The actually easiest way to go off and to get this working again is to uninstall the feature and then reinstall the feature again and reprovision it again with group policy objects. So it's a little bit wonky for how it goes, but that's basically the best way to go off and to provision it.
Your question.
Questions or offline sites?
So your question is discovering these things in hosted situations or offline sites, correct?
Yeah.
That the part that I missed? Now Rick, I'm not sure on those requirements.
Yeah. So once you start to use this utility, you can put in any data you want inside this database. So if you do have an offline disconnected site, you can obviously include it inside the address space and the blocks of address space. A block is simply another unit of how you organize your space. That you can call whatever you like. Maybe it's a block by building or a block by floor within a building. And you can manually add stuff. And you can manually add in your own things. You can also go through and do exports of information from third-party DHCP servers, Cisco routers, other IP address solutions. As long as you can get a CSV to export, you can do a CSV import into this if you wanted to, and also gain more and more information. So that's basically the big thing of learning how to do it. One thing I forgot to do, of course, is the scoping of stuff, which is over here, configuring the server discovery. So I went straight from 1 and 2, and no one mentioned that I skipped step 3. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I forgot step number 3. This is where you have to go in and basically go through and choose what is the domain that you want to go off and discover. Who am I querying with Active Directory? I'm currently querying nobody. That's why nobody's showing up. So that's the one I want to go off and query. And what do I want to go off and manage? Domain controllers, DHCP servers, and DNS servers. Bring them in. And then it warns you that you have to have your group policy stuff in place and then schedule this guy to go off and to run. Now that he's done with one domain selected, you can now start to go off and kick off a discovery. And then this is where it's going to continue on and finish and go from there.
Real stuff.
Yeah.
we make mistakes too.
When this came out back when 2012 was released, I've had a couple of friends of mine contact me who work in the ISP space, and they're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that this is now available and it's free inside the box. You'll notice it's a bit rough around the edges because it is a V1 solution for its implementation right now. What I'm pleasantly surprised and happy to see is the fact that it is still in R2, which means that there's definitely value. People are definitely using this, and so we've continued to make that investment and make it even better to be able to make it more scalable, more robust, and also ability to manage more. By configuring your server discovery, that's how you scope stuff, because maybe you're only responsible for the DHCP and the infrastructure in the UK. You're not responsible for it in the southern continent. You're not responsible for it in North America. So that's how you're able to go off and to partition off who's responsible for what. It's still going through that lovely little progress bar. I'm doing that query across the top there. Once this done, I'll be able to click on number 5, and you'll see what it has discovered. I basically flip a tiny bit in the database that says this is a managed system because I have rights over it, and that will allow me to start to go off and to query that guy. Ultimately, what this does, come on, give it to me. Still nothing yet. Can't do it. Not done. Ultimately, what this does, it comes back with a list of domain controllers, list of DNS servers, list of DHCP servers. I can then choose, are they managed, yes or no? And then if they are managed by this particular implementation, it will then very simply go through and update a filter on those three group policy objects that limits it to only affect the IPAM targets that are out there. What this does is it opens up firewall ports, makes sure services are running, makes sure they're properly configured. They can now be accessed remotely by the IPAM server. Any activity you use to humanize and modernize that database and or issue new addresses or do other things along those lines, any of those activities will be done by the IPAM server itself. You won't actually be used with your own credentials. It will be used for its credentials to be able to do the management of it. And there we go. Here's a couple that are there that have come in. In the interest of time, I'll just show you these guys here. You literally come up here and you say, okay, DHCP server. I say edit server. And I choose, I want to monitor this guy. It detected that there was domain controller responsibilities and DNS responsibilities. I can put in additional human information for owner description, additional custom configuration of fields, like what building it is, what floor it's on, that sort of stuff, what site it's in. I'm just going to go through here and simply say, manage this guy. What that does is it comes back now with a blocked status and currently set to managed. That now will have a background process that kicks off and updates the filter of the computer account on the group policy object that controls managing and monitoring domain controllers. And the next GPO refresh cycle in this box will kick in and I'll be able to manage them. IPAM is one of those things you can start off and work inside your environment. If you have access to create group policy objects and you have administrative access inside your environment, you can do this non-intrusively without actually screwing up anything to do with your IP addressing, just to start to get a feel for how to humanize that IP address side of things.
Beauty.
And with that, we got about a minute and a half left or so. I wanted to finish off with some related content.
Now, these sessions are being recorded. You'll be able to watch them on Channel 9. If you want to go back and watch the version that Rick did
in North America,
they are already up today, but these sessions will be posted up. There is a first session that we didn't actually do here, which is kind of a broad overview session that you can go back and watch. So we've done the Active Directory piece.
Yep.
We've done the networking infrastructure piece, showed you how to migrate. We're pretty much off of our 2003 environment. However, there's these things called pesky file servers.
Yeah, no one has file servers they care about, eh?
Right.
You guys got terabytes of data you got to worry about moving? That's so the next session coming up after this one here.
We're going to talk about that one in the next session. In the interest of time, there's, of course, your resources. I'm sure you've seen this slide at the end of session. I do want to thank all of you for coming. I know it's Friday. It's at the end of the event. brains are probably full. Please help us better these sessions. Let us know what your feedback is. Fours and fives are good, four overall, five for the speaker scores and others. Please evaluate these sessions. If we see you in just a few minutes after the next break, I look forward to seeing you there. Otherwise, thank you very much. Enjoy Tech Ed and have safe travels home. Thank you very much.